Hello and welcome to a Taylor's Tales podcast. This is Chris's Corner. I'm your host, Chris Taylor, and we're back this week with a new history episode. I know, I said I was going to do it. I have done it, and we're back here talking this week about Japanese history, specifically the samurai. Yes, a fascinating group of people who have provided the world with some just downright fascinating way of life. It's very different to how the West looks at life. And I think it revolves around Zen Buddhism and specifically Bushido. We'll get into these topics as we go along. I'll grab my notes here and we'll get started. So the period we're going to be covering over this sort of hour podcast will be from around 900 AD all the way up until 1800 AD, and it's the main period of the samurai, which ranges from around, I'd say, 1100 all the way up until around the Edo period. And then after that, there is a slow decline for them. So it's a very specific period. There's, you know, that's a long time. That's a 900 year period of history. I'm going to condense it down. We're going to go through it. You know, if you have any questions, again, ping me in the email from there on out. But let's crack on, as we did with the Russian history podcast. So samurai, what does samurai mean? Samurai specifically means to serve. And this was back in, I think, around 900 AD, when feudal Japan wasn't a thing yet. And there were lots of landlords, as you would put it, throughout Japan at the time. And these landlords required warriors to be able to, well, you know, that you could call them henchmen, or you could call them bodyguards in this case, where they would defend the land that their landlords owned. And in this case, the samurai would have to fend off other sort of land owners sort of invasions and something like that. So going from this, so the samurai's purpose was to defend their landmasters. And after the Taika, and you're going to have to, once again, bear with my pronunciations of certain names, Taika or Taika reforms of the 642 to 46 AD, so yes, not 900, which included land distribution and heavy new taxes, which meant the support of an elaborate Chinese star empire. Now, I'm going to emphasize on this is that the Japanese were heavily influenced by the Chinese empire all the way from around the early 600s, as you can see here, all the way up until, I would say, the 1500 period onwards. And then from there, they are influenced by the Americans in the 1800s. And that is what causes the fall of the samurai. And we'll get into that later. So the reforms forced many small farmers to sell their land and work as tenants for these new landlords, as I've spoken about before. And these new landlords would basically provide protection for these tenants, but at the same time, they were making a lot of profit. And this is what slowly forged Japan into a feudal system. This created a feudal system that forced landlords to hire the samurai, or bushi. So I'm pretty sure the word bushi, bodyguard or henchman or warrior in this case, is referring to Bushido, because it refers from bushi, warrior, to their rules, the warrior code, aka Bushido. And we'll get into that as well. Some samurai were related to the landlords, which they protected, and others were hired swords. The hired swords, a fun fact here, were known as ronin. It was highly, highly irregular for samurai to be ronin. There was a level of code within the samurai to hold to their landmasters or to their landlords, and to protect the tenants and families of the land that they protected. Being a ronin was very, there was very few of them. It was sparse, and the ronin were considered to be mercenaries. And there was a lack of respect for them during this entire period, all the way ranging from the early 900s all the way up until the 1800s. So we talked about it. The term has been around since the 70s. Well, yeah, so samurai itself wasn't, they weren't called samurai back then. They were called by the Japanese word bushi. And the samurai term wasn't created until around 17th century, around that time, which is around the 1600s, I believe. It started when England started traveling the world, as well as Portugal, and these earlier empires started to be able to try and traverse these lands, these unknown periods, with Christopher Columbus and others later, from the Spanish Empire, trying to going out to the West. There was others going to the East, and we had different travelers for these parts. So the Samurai Code. The Samurai Code was emphasized on loyalty to one's master, as we've stated before. Also known as Bushido, the 8 virtues were considered in this case, and this is very linked to Zen Buddhism in the sense that frugality, righteousness, courage, benevolence, respect, sincerity, honor, at loyalty and self-control were the terms used for samurai to uphold to oneself and to one's masters. This created a rigid lifestyle for them to follow on a day-to-day basis. It's kind of interesting. We compare it to today's society where everything is flexibility. Everything has, anyone can be anything, and we all create and we put on the internet and we create content. And you think that in comparison, these lifestyles, you know, they created a level of content in these samurai's lives, actually fulfillment, to the point where they would uphold it to such an extent that they could commit seppuku, also known as committing suicide. But in their case, it was honorable to do so. And we'll get into that as well. So a samurai's legally entitled to cut down any commoner who failed to honor him or her properly. I'd like to emphasize the word her there. So even back in the early sort of 900s, 800 period, they would have female samurai, and you would have male samurai. It wasn't common, but they were there. And it's important to emphasize that because it's, every painting you see of a samurai, every sort of description you'll see as a man, that's also the case when it comes down to the Greek Spartans. Very similar concept to draw between the two lifestyles in the sense of the rigid sort of structure that they would have. And they're fascinating, both of them. They provide insight into a lifestyle that is no longer conceptualized except in maybe the lifestyle of Shaolin monks, and that sort of dedication to one's life. So let's get into, so we've talked about, this is a nice overview, this could just give you some background around the samurai before we go into the history, before they were created, before they were, you know, into their prime years and how they ended. And I hope you understand that this is as much entertaining to me as it is, hopefully, for you, the listener, and for those watching. Religion. Zen Buddhism. It's austere and simple rituals, as well as the belief that salvation would come from within, provide an ideal philosophical background for the samurai's own code of behavior. This is exactly it right here. Zen Buddhism, as well as providing the idea that you can become better by oneself. There's a lack of deities within this religion. It is purely around the ability to determine your own fate. And I myself can relate very much to this religion. I can understand why the samurai did as well. Warriors looked towards other warriors. In this religion, it was good to have someone to look up to. And specifically in Buddhism, you look to Buddha, who is not a god or a deity, but rather somebody to look up to who set the right example. Interestingly enough, we don't have many of these people in today's society setting the right example. We have a few, we don't have many, but it's interesting to see these, a similar aspect of Buddhism put into today's society. with warriors setting a high bar for people to reach, but reach nonetheless. Also during the Kamakura period, the sword came to have a greater significance in its significance in samurai culture. A man's honor was said to reside in his sword and his craftsmanship of swords, including carefully hammered blades, gold, silver inlay, and shark skin hand grips became an art in itself. Now, why would I put that within religion, you may ask? Because the way the samurai looked after items would then later down the line have such an influence on Japanese society that even in today's society, you'll know that the Japanese look after their own items with such care and such a meaning behind items that they own that they have a fantastic resale value and a fantastic second-hand selling properties within the country. And it's fascinating to see that within Buddhism, you see this sort of, not just for human beings and for other animals to be treated with care, but also within items as well. And it does, although it goes against the sense of wanting to gain land and gain wealth, which Buddhism doesn't really place a lot of stock in, it's still really interesting to see that religion can be placed within how you care for yourself, the things you use, and also the people around you. And we see that within the samurai and how they treat their swords, their people, and how they pray to them, their, I wouldn't say gods, but in this case, pray to their spirits, their peoples, their ancestors. I would say they look for these sort of semi-righteous people. So, we've talked about religion, we've talked about the samurai code, and a little overview of what samurai truly means. The creation of the samurai and their power came about in the Heian era in the 900 AD. The Japanese lost control of rural, so the Heians lost control of rural Japan, and the country was torn apart by a revolt. It wasn't until the Genpei War of 1180 to 1185 that the samurai would gain more influence, because within that period of 900 where the Heians lost control of the rural Japan, there was a huge divide. The Heians controlled Kyoto and the southern part of Japan, while the northern part was controlled by clans, specifically called, at that time, they weren't called samurai, but they were a warrior guerrilla group who knew how to shoot arrows on horseback and were able to basically use guerrilla warfare to fight off the infantry-based Chinese system within the South. The South used a very Chinese structural system when it came down to war and to politics, but the North was very much so a, what we would call today, samurai-based culture. It's very different. It's got a fascinating start to the samurai's life. And as I've said here, the true power of the samurai when it comes to the entire country of Japan didn't really come about until the 1100s period, because between then there was still that huge divide between the south and the north, as we've seen in many countries, and as we saw within the Russian history. The war, which is between two feuding clans, was resolved with one of the most famous samurai heroes in Japanese history, Minamoto Yoshitsune, who led his clan to victory. This led to the creation of the Kakukura Shogunate, a kind of hereditary military dictatorship where political power shifted to the samurai. Now, what we're talking about when it comes down to a shogunate, we're talking about basically a general, a military leader who doesn't answer to anyone other than basically what they would consider their deities, their religion. He was the highest person. There was no one higher. Even the emperor lost political powers at this time and didn't have much influence other than through the shogunate. If the shogunate had a say, it would be that's it. There was no other resolve behind it. And so from there, we see in the post-Ganpei War, a period of the shogunate, basically, from here on out, and which the samurai have a greater part to play throughout this period. So following the victory, Minamoto no Yorimoto established the shogunate, retaining the emperor as a figurehead. So, as I've said, he was merely there as some would say, as a face for the country to have. This has happened in many nations before, where there is no political or military power behind the, I've got to remember, not the emperor, the sort of lineage of the kingship within that country. We've seen it a few times. I'm trying to think off the top of my head if there's anyone within Russia. Maybe you could consider Nicholas II after he had to abdicate. Abdication, very similar sequence to this. So the Minamoto clan ruled much of Japan until 1333, which is fascinating. It's a huge period of time. That's 200 years of a clan managing to control an entire nation like Japan, where there is diversity and there is a very strict lifestyle. It also does put into question how strict the samurai have to be within their lifestyle. And we're going to get into that now with the Mongol king of China. So during this period of rule under the Minamoto clan, the Chinese saw Japan as, after their civil war, a weak Japan. And so in 1268 AD, an external threat appeared. The Kublai clan, a Mongol ruler of Yuan China, demanded tribute from Japan. And when Kyoto refused, the Mongols invaded. Fortunately for Japan, a typhoon destroyed the Mongols' 600 ships, and a second invasion fleet in 1280 met the same fate. So we just had basically an external threat. An external threat from China, controlled by the Mongols, in which case the Japanese wouldn't necessarily have a lot of hope against an army of the size of the Mongols. They had a very similar guerrilla warfare style. There was very little difference in that sense. They had a very ruthless style, as they were able to control much of the Eastern Europe as well as all of the East as well under Genghis Khan. Also another fascinating character throughout history, and I hope to cover him at some point. This guy, the Mongol controller thought, you know what, we'll send our ships, 600 ships. 600. You think about that, with how many men would be on those ships ready to attack the Japanese. This was pure luck. There was no way about it for the Japanese. The fact it happened twice shows how treacherous the Japanese sea is between China and Japan. And it's absolutely fascinating to see that not only did it happen once, it happened twice over, and I'm pretty sure, yeah, that's a, you know, that's a long period of time, 20 years, to try again 20 years later and then have this met the same fate. It's, you know, after that, you would never try that again, would you? So, moving on to a later period, like I said, this is a lot to cover. The Muromachi period and the restoration of order. By 1460 or 1460, the daimyos were ignoring orders from the shogun and backing different successors to the imperial throne. The shogunate no longer had the power that they previously had between the 1100 to 1300 period. When the shogun Ashikaga Yoshimasa resigned in 1464, a dispute between the backers of the Yuan brother and his son ignited even more intense fighting among the daimyo. In 1467, the squabbling erupted into a decade-long Onin War in which thousands died and Kyoto was burned to the ground. I'm pretty sure some of the castles within Kyoto still stand to this day, but a lot of the surrounding areas are completely brand new. And it's very similar in the sense of what happened to Tokyo in World War II when there was a massive earthquake and basically all of the surrounding Edo area was destroyed and they had to rebuild. And it's a lot of that happens to Japan through natural disaster, but in this case, we see it through pure fighting and destruction. The war led directly to Japan's Warring States period, or Sengoku. Between 1467 and 1573, various daimyos led their clans in a fight for national dominance, and nearly all of the provinces were engulfed in fighting. Daimyo is like clans. Again, sorry, I should have clarified that. That the idea of these, each clan within Japan, because of the feudal system, as I've said, landowners, and as the years went by, these landowners grew, and each piece of land felt like they deserved to control Japan. Very similar to how the shogunate was elected, mainly a mass land owner or somebody of great military power. So, the Warring States drew to a close in 1568 when the warlord Oda Nobunaga defeated three powerful daimyos, marched into Kyoto, and had his preferred leader, Yoshiaki, installed as shogun. Nobunaga spent the next 14 years subduing other rival daimyos and quelling rebellions by fractious Buddhist monks. My goodness. You know it's bad when Buddhist monks are getting involved. His Azuchi Castle, constructed between 1576 and 1579, became a symbol of Japanese unification. It's interesting to see another unification during this period. It wasn't until the 1800s that countries like even Italy became unified, and even within the United Kingdom, which through hundreds of years of battling, similar to Japan, became unified under one leader, but there was consistent battling to see who would control these countries. It's a similar aspect, as you saw with Elizabeth I and Mary Queen of Scots. You saw it with people like Henry Tudor's father, Henry VII having to battle for the War of the Roses. We saw it with in France when we had multiple rising up by the people before Napoleon became leader and was there were no longer any kings of France. We've seen it within Russia in the previous podcast, where different people thought they had the right to the throne. Very different perspectives for each clan. They all thought they had royal blood. In this case, it's not even emperors. We're talking about shogunites and shoguns who were military leaders, who basically used the emperor as a face for the people, and then they would control the power of the country through military force. In 1582, Nobunaga was assassinated by one of his generals, Akichi Mitsuhide. Haidu Yoshi, another general, finished the unification and ruled as Kampaku, or regent, invading Korea in 1592 and 1597. I'd like to point out that there is a horrible relationship between Korea and Japan through these horrific wars, mainly from the Japanese side, where Korea was consistently invaded, consistently basically just torn apart by the Japanese. And to this day, there is a negative feeling between both countries, although the Japanese refuse to admit for any of the faults. And I think that there's a similar vibe coming from Korea as well. Although I cannot, you know, speak for this as I'm from the UK. I need to stop saying that. There's no more ums in this podcast. The Tokugawa shogunate of the Edo period. Now, the Edo period was the strongest period of time for the samurai. It was a period of time where there was basically peace within Japan. There was less war. Huge amounts of fighting had stopped. The Edo period was a very strong part for Japan. They started to build an empire. They started to really become a known quantity by other nations. And I believe countries like the Netherlands, Portugal landed sailors to start trading between the countries and settlers there. And I also believe that Christianity was the tried to move into the Japanese area at that time. But I can't give you a specific date. I'll have to think about that in a second. So, Hideyoshi exiled the large Tokuyana clan from the area around Kyoto to Kanto region in eastern Japan. By 1600, Tokugawa Ieyasu had conquered the neighboring Daimyo from his castle stronghold at Edo, which would one day become Tokyo. Ieyasu's son, Hidetada, became shogun on a unified country in 1605, ushering in a 250 years of relative peace and stability for Japan. The strong Tokugawa shoguns domesticated the samurai, forcing them to either serve their lords in the cities or give up their swords and farm. This transformed the warriors into a class of cultured bureaucrats. Fascinating period of time. I know I keep saying this, but it really is. How does a people like the samurai, as we've stated, rigid to the core when it comes down to how they live, almost over a 250-year period, go from holding the strength of a land through war and through basically military control to becoming basically farmers? And I think the answer is that, as we've seen, as we've talked about these huge periods of chunks of time, is that these samurai, basically, they thrive in war. And that's, you know, that's an obvious point. These are warriors. These are men who serve masters, and masters who do not fear the death of a warrior. And in this case, committing, you know, seppuku, dying an honorable death, this was meaning for the samurai. They wanted to die an honorable death, very similar to the Vikings. The Vikings wanted a death where they would enter Valhalla and they would have to die with their sword on their chest. It's a fascinating death, and it's meaning that still holds true to some people this day, with people joining the armies of the world and fighting and believing in their dying for the righteous cause. I think it's something very human in this, and it's very relatable when it comes down to talking about the samurai and other warrior clans. So after being transformed into bureaucrats or farmers, there were still samurai. And we're talking about the Meiji Restoration and the end of the samurai here. In 1868, the Meiji Restoration signaled the beginning of the end for the samurai. The Meiji system of constitutional monarchy included such domestic reforms as terms limiting public officials and popular balloting, again echoing in a system of Western system. As you can see here in the 1800s, there's no longer this sort of tyrannical ruling. It seems that the samurai work within a specific system, a specific feudal system, and that in this period of time the Japanese are trying to become more Western, more civilized. There's less war, and so there's less need for the samurai. And in this case, we see a loss of meaning for this warrior clan. With public support, the Meiji Emperor did away with the samurai and reduced the power of the daimyo and changed the capital's name from Edo to Tokyo. The new government created conscripted army in 1873. Some of the officers were drawn from the ranks of former samurai, but more of the warriors found work as police officers. In 1877, angry ex-samurai revolted against the Meiji in the Samutsu-suma Rebellion. But they later lost the Battle of Shirayama, bringing in the end area of the samurai to an end. You may have watched The Last Samurai, one of my favorite movies. Absolutely fantastically done in the sense of honor and showing that rigidness in how they lived, with the shot of arrows, the fighting between men, the idea that there was meaning in everything they did, from religion to how they fought and how they loved and how they looked after their communities. I would be fascinated to know who, if that is relatively similar, if there was any trueness behind the way that's portrayed in the movie. If not, anyway, doesn't matter. So I've just condensed an extremely 900 period within to the space of half an hour. The idea behind this was to get a nice overview of the samurai and to understand how political powers and general movement of governments can really influence the way a warrior clan moves. Japan as itself has a huge history that I could go into for an hour as well, but I saw with the Russian history that I delved in very deep into a topic that I knew relatively something about, having studied it before, but this is new for me. So I've tried to get this as a nice overview, short podcast that has given you a glimpse into the samurai and given you an idea behind how they started, what gave them their power, and how they ended and what was the cause behind their ending. From my opinion, the ending was due to a more civilized society that didn't require the needs for warriors and went with a more Western style lifestyle. However, the influence of the samurai would echo into, as I've stated before, into the very today's Japanese society, with the looking after of items, the specific like rigidity of their sort of society, their ability to uphold honor, their wanting to live a meaningful life. There's still a lot of Buddhism within the country itself, so there's still that meaning there. It's a fascinating time to see Japan at the moment, because while they are a more civilized society, they are like any other country, like England, Japan, you know, Japan, New Zealand, Australia, America, wherever you are, they still have their past still there. There is still that level of professionalism, however you want to put it, that the samurai, I believe, have influenced through the honor system and their code that today is still in Japan. So, ending this podcast with some fun facts about the samurai, and we've covered a very, you know, brief hint of what they're like. If a samurai didn't have a lord or master, as I've said before this, either because their master had died or the samurai had fallen out of favor, they were known as ronin, a Japanese expression for a wandering man. Oh, I didn't say that earlier. Because a samurai was, according to Bushido, supposed to kill himself after his master's death, or if dishonored himself, ronin were the bad boys of the feudal Japan and floated social codes. Fascinated. Bad boys love that term. It's fascinating. Because they didn't commit seppuku, they were, as I said earlier, mercenaries, most likely. If a samurai failed and was captured by the enemy, they were expected to commit ritual suicide in the process known as seppuku, which involved self-disembowelment and considered an extremely honorable way to die. This happened by his own hand, was followed at times by decapitation by an attendant, albeit somewhat a messy process. As historian Stephen Turnbull put it, in the world of warrior, seppuku was a deed of bravery that was admirable in a samurai who knew he was defeated, mortally wounded. Finally, at the end of this podcast, something that I found fascinating, Star Wars' Darth Vader was influenced by the look of the samurai. Specifically, his neck guard on the Darth Vader helmet was actually inspired by the samurai's Kamputo helmet, which had the neck sort of plate clipped onto the helmet. And it was very difficult to design the entire helmet of the samurai, and it took hours, and they, like I said before, they took their time with their armor, their swords, and they specifically made them in a way that would last long periods of time and would be passed down from generation to generation. but nonetheless, fun fact, having Darth Vader being inspired by the samurai. It does make sense. George Lucas wanted this feared warrior who would cut down anyone in his way, basically. And so very similar to the where the samurai, in the sense that they would go at any pace or any way to honor themselves and defeat their enemies. Fantastic way to end the podcast. This has been a nice short podcast. This has been a Taylor's Tales podcast. This is Chris's Corner. I'm your host, Chris Taylor. And as always, I hope to see you here next week. Thank you for listening.